Blog Talk Radio.
All right, good morning, Waco, Texas, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, ATL, America, the world, everybody that's listening, welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. I'm going to take, y'all see that lady up in the upper right? I'm scared of her. I'm scared, not scared, scared. This lady's profile is impeccable. And once again, we bring straight talk, straight hard talk on topics that need to be talked about. This is not, say it again for the folks in the back, this is not a hate police channel. It's not a black folks channel, a white folks channel, Christian, Republican, gay, straight. No. In here, we're going to come truth. And you're going to get to hear from people who have experience on these issues that we talk about that are bringing you what you don't know. Because there is so much about policing that you all do not know. Now, warning up front. You will hear colorful metaphors, agitated adjectives, better known as curse words. You have police officers on here, and we speak in a language that oftentimes is the only adjectives we have for the situations we've seen or we're talking about or we've lived in. So when I do it, I put money in the curse jar, I donate to charity, and we move on. And you know, today I wanted to talk about, and by the way, for the haters, who hates the show? He just hates cops. Or this is now the seventh show that we have done on police suicides. The seventh. At 2 hours, that is 14 hours that we have given to this topic, which is more than any of your major media networks, any of most of y'all's departments in training, and we bring it hard and we bring it real. And so I'm going to say good morning to the co-host, and then we're going to get to the guest, and we're going straight in. And I got my baby girl down there. Hey, girl. You know, down there in the bottom. Let me go first off. Joe, good morning. How you doing, brother?
I'm excellent, man. There's no need for me to say anything. I'm ready to go. So I'll pass the mic.
To you.
All right. All right. Big job. What's up?
Good morning, everyone. I'm ecstatic, man. I'm honored to be on this show this morning, and really excited to today. My granddaughter is going to college out in Atlanta to withstand, so I got police protection out that way for her. So I'm excited. So let's get going.
All right, bro. You know I got it. And you know what? For all and this guy here, I got to give him his ups. This is a chief that has the balls enough to come on the show every single week and speak truth. Whether rich folks, black folks, white folks, pro police, anti-police, no matter who's hurt, this is one of the few. And he's in the small department. And for any of you to go, well, it's easy for him, he's in the small department. All that means is they can get rid of you quicker. Okay? But he does it. And some of you big-time chiefs that are all over CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and wherever, maybe you ought to be listening to this chief. And his wife lets him come here every Saturday and sit out in the yard or wherever he is and do this show. And that lady, and I can tell you from my wife's perspective, she catches untold hell just for him being here. And she lets him do it. And yes, you're the chief, but she lets you do it. Good morning, brother.
You're absolutely right. I am in the backyard. Good morning from the back porch in Texas.
Y'all got books in the backyard.
No, I'm on it again. Always, it's honor. I'm honored to be here. Excited about this show. This is a topic that is pretty near and dear to me. So I'll just say this without delaying it any further. If we're going to talk about reimagining police, this is one of the topics that should jump up to the front, right? If we're going to fix these issues that we have, this is the number one issue facing law enforcement today. And so fix your minds and look and figure these things out. And with that, I'm ready to kick it off.
All right. Our investigative journalist down here, Isadora. What's up, Izzy? How's your week, bro?
You're doing good. Happy to be here. Sorry I'm a little bit late. Had a little Wi-Fi trouble. But, yeah, everything that you said is dead on. This is definitely one of the most important and also one of the most untalked about problems facing policing today. I think too often we like to just think about these people as heroes, which a lot of them are, but that whole hero ideology kind of takes away the humanity of the job. And, yeah, that's about all I got to say. I'm glad I'm ready to get into it.
All right, brother. Now we're gonna get to the guest down there. We'll wait on Claire to get back. I got to go over to my brother. I met him in the midst of, he came to Waco to present Safe Call Now, which is an outreach program for first responders struggling with addictions and mental health concerns. And I work midnight, so, of course, his presentation was during our midnight shift. I come out of roll call. We're here, and we got to go up and hear, you know, this 45-minute dissertation, presentation, whatever. And when the department signs on to something, typically with street officers, it's, oh, here comes some bullshit. Who threw this here? And that was my mentality. And I walked up, and I sat in a row, and I listened to him. And Sean came hard, much like you guys listening to the show with me. That's how he came, language-wise and otherwise. And on the first break, I went up to him, and I introduced myself. And I said, you probably heard of me here. I'm sure you have. I'm not well-liked, but nevertheless, I'm here. And I appreciate what you're saying, and I enjoy listening to you. And our friendship built from there. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Thank you for having the show today, Sam.
Oh, yeah, brother. How's everything?
We're doing a great conference, great work today here in West Virginia. It's actually applies to what we're going to talk about today because David Kwan, Dr. Keith Marshall, who you know very well, is here, and we're working with the community with nurses, doctors, and on mental health, and firefighters, and people in addiction. We brought the whole community together to train, so it's working out pretty well, and they get some pretty good tips on how to help the police population.
And you know what's cool, Sean? If I'm wrong, don't you have addicts sitting next to officers?
Yeah, we did on this training. It's the first time we tried doing it, and it's really, well, maybe it's not surprising, I don't know, but they are getting along so well and communicating that you want to talk about reimagining, like the chief said, you want to talk about de-escalation. De-escalation is happening in this room right now because
mm-hmm.
they're communicating and they're understanding there's true de-escalation, and it's amazing of watching what's happening.
All right, brother. Now I gotta go up to. I'm scared of this lady because she got so much. Your profile and your accomplishments are impeccable. Caliber Press, Police One. You know, I mean, I just, and you were so cool. We're talking on the phone, and then I go back and I research you, and I'm just like, oh my God, she's bringing all this weight. But what I love is when Sean proposed the idea, and I said, when he told me about just that, Sean, we got to get her on. And then when I asked you, you were like, sure, let's do it. I mean, no, talk to my media consultant. Go over here. Talk. You were like straight here. Good morning, Ms. Betsy Smith. How are you?
Good morning from Blackstaff, Arizona.
Yeah. AZ, how's everything going?
We have been so busy. I'm now the spokesman for the National Police Association, and we've been doing tons and tons of media. But I'm excited to be with a terrific group of people today. I'm very excited, and I want to debut my 90-day post chemotherapy hair.
Oh, love it. You look stunning. You look stunning. And you know what? You have that spirit. Yeah, I mean, that's what I love. And I caught from when you and Sean and I, when we were talking, and Sean will tell you, and everybody on here knows, I click with people where I don't. It's not that they're bad people. I'm a fighter, and I love fighters. You know, and so I'm just so humbled that you're here. Thank you so much. And I'm going to go down to another guest. This is my baby down there at the bottom. This is my adopted police daughter. This lady is near and dear to my heart. I would walk through the halls, new officers come, I would say good morning or hello, and I'm just going to my car, load my stuff. Because what typically happens with new officers is they come, they get their little role models or whatever anybody told them to emulate. That's what they do. They get in their car, they go out, and they want to be like Mike. And Mike ain't necessarily all he is. But there was something with her that I saw. We built this this bond where I spend time with her that I didn't spend with people I worked with 15 years. I'm like, hello, how you doing? And I'm ready to go hit the streets. But she became very special. So at this time, if you're still there, Claire, can you come on and say good morning to everybody?
I am. Good morning, everybody. My name is Claire. Yes, me and Stan knew each other from the Waco Police Department. We knew each other fairly well. I mean, like Stan said, we got to know each other in a short period of time, but there was something there, and I'm telling you, he's a great guy, and I'm happy to be here, Karen.
All right. Appreciate you, dear. Let's get right on into the topic. For me, I got to go up front first. We got to go to the top and work our way back down. I want to talk about for a second the George Floyd Act and what really aggravated me or pissed me off with that. First off, 38 states have ratified most of the stuff that's in it. But that being said, what bothered me with the George Floyd Act was the way it was written and the way it was presented under the auspices of police reform. It was written to say that it is the police against the community. It was not an encompassing bill, and we fail to recognize police come from the community. So two of the things that stuck out to me that were not in there is whistleblower protection on a state, county, and municipal level that the feds have, which would, number one, help in police reform. But most important was there was nothing in there about mental health for police officers. Nothing. Police unions endorsed these candidates. Not one of these unions held these candidates, Republican or Democrat, to the fire and said, we have people dying. Not because of what the citizen did, not because of what happened on the traffic stop, but because between their bills, the departmental politics, the bullshit that's in the profession that we all know exists in roll calls before we hit the street. You got to take all that mess and then go out to other people's mess. And then come home to your bills and your family problems. And it bothers me that none of this is from the political aspect on the federal or state level. Is there meaningful legislation that's coming in? Floor is open, Chief. Betsy. Sean. What's your feelings on it?
Let me help you with that. First off, I think that the overarching problem is Title of Act in itself. I think it's kind of insulting for those of us who are good policemen that we get painted with the same brush. Now, that's part one. The second part we have to talk about is the DSM-5 category of what is PTSD. I think we have a problem with defining that and placing that in the police world. Now, the thing is this. Just this week, and I posted some article on their site this week, Chicago right now is 64% higher than national average of suicide. Listen to that, 64% higher. Now, I got to say hello to Sean and thank him. I had an officer shot less than a month ago, and I had to reach out to Sean because my guys are breaking down. And the problem that I had was that the rest of the department didn't see what I saw. Now, the other part of that, I will say this to anyone, I've also been involved in a shooting. I've involved and investigated them. So I've been on both sides of the aisle, investigator and investigatee. So my perspective is a little bit different than most. But again, I go back to very base fact. The fact is that the hierarchs of these different departments don't realize what's going on at the bottom, for lack of a better term, wrong of the departments. And I'll leave it at that.
I think Joe's 100% right, because I look at the situation, and so we see these bills come out, we see this reform come out, but we see, the old structure. We've got peer support, we've got ICIFM, we've got somebody doing this, somebody doing that, and what it looks like to me is some actual check boxes. What we don't have is, can you show me incremental growth, incremental gain on making an officer healthy so they don't get to the point of committing suicide? And in order to do that, you got to step outside your current box that is governing whatever police work looks like to get to those solutions, because they're not sitting inside there, but they are sitting out there. And that's when someone gets to the point where they need help, that's where we move them. And my question is, how come we're waiting until this last minute to call me to move the person. That's my whole point. When we can just move this straight in to the system, my whole goal, and I've seen this, known this since day one, if I can run that phone line out of business, that means everybody's getting help at the level that they need. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to drive it back and wait until it gets to a crisis.
You know, Sean, before I want to ask Betsy this question, because she was a supervisor. And this is what really, when in the show title, I had a subtitle called The Dysfunctional Family, which is not geared at say, please do everything wrong. What I was saying in that is, you know, we go out every day and we spot people and we say, you're drunk, you're on drugs, you're suicidal, you're not. But we all sit in roll calls, shoulder to shoulder, with the man or woman with the drinking problem, or whether it's steroids or any other drug. We sit there. We talk to these people. We're around them, and we do nothing. Then we lay a blue wreath and put the honor guard out there, and all that. We do all the dog and pony sympathetic things, and this is not, I don't say that to take anything away from police ceremonies, but we do semantical bullshit, not so much for respect for the family, but to cover up our failures as a family to take care of each other. Betsy, what do you think?
Well, I lost three colleagues to suicide in my 29 years on the job. And yeah, I had officers with addiction issues, mental health issues. Everybody does. Every police department does. And it's so difficult because there has to be balance for the agency between taking care of that officer and also taking care of the agency. You know, I'm sure the chief can talk about this. There's liability issues, and we don't do a good job of getting these officers help, because the minute an officer steps forward and says, I have an addiction issue, or I'm thinking about hurting myself, that all the screens go up and it's like, whoa, we've got to protect the agency and protect our reputation and all of that. And that officer who's asking for help very often gets pushed to the side.
Absolutely.
It's abhorrent. And so now we're in this atmosphere where cops are, you know, the last year are being, you know, we're just being vilified and excoriated. And, you know, and I agree that the George Floyd Act, maybe get that, what that says to police officers around the country is, you know, you're all Derek Chauvin, you're all killers, you know, you're racist, you're this, you're that. But hey, go out and do your job and don't have any problems at home and make sure you're nice to the community. And like you said, Stan, we are the community. And yet we don't talk about it anymore. I mean, we can go back and back and back, and, you know, every college kid with a criminal justice, you know, 101 class learns about Sir Robert Peel, the people are the police and the police are the people. We stop telling you about that altogether. And, you know, it's such a complicated issue. It's an emotional issue. But this is the time now, and I want to emphasize that to law enforcement leaders. Now we've got the attention of the media, finally, about police officer mental health. To the politicians, we got your attention about police officer mental health. But it's not just four officers who work on two different Washington, D.C. area police departments that have mental health issues. We've got to talk about all 50 states. We've got to talk about the 800,000 police officers out there and our retirees who have managed to survive that job, and now they're retired and sitting at home. And they're having issues, too. This is a huge issue. And we got to talk about it.
It is. Go ahead, Chief.
She's 100% correct. I mean, this has been our dirty little secret for decades. This has been going on forever. You know, and the main place has been brought to light. I mean, here we are now talking about it. We have to focus on it. We have been talking about it. This topic has come up every single stinking year when we put in a new president for the International Chiefs of Police. This is an issue that is discussed. Right? But it gets some traction. It doesn't go anywhere. And they try to figure out, well, how are we going to put this into place? You know, so as an agency leader, you've got to remove the stigma. right? We've got to get them to be able to come in, have a psychologically safe environment for people to come forward, right? That becomes important. So you have to have a good program in place. Once we get to that point, there's got to be measures in policy that don't make this punitive, right? We've got to understand that the mission is to get them the help versus to penalize them. So in Texas, Sean and I spoke a little bit earlier, Texas just passed some legislation for mandated mental health days for law enforcement after a traumatic event. It's not anything spectacular. It's stuff that we were kind of already doing internally. Because, as a chief, I can put somebody on administrative leave of pay when we have certain behaviors that manifest themselves. And I've done it where we've pulled them out, said, hey, you've got some issues going on. We start pushing them forward to get this type of help. And like everybody else on here, I know officers that have committed suicide, but friends of mine, I don't think that anybody that's been in this business does not know somebody that has not gone down this path and or had major addiction issues. But to speak on the George Floyd incident and those that may be listening, I'm not sure the politicians talked to the people that they spoke to the people they needed to speak to on that piece of legislation. A lot of the things I would say that came out of it, Texas was already doing, so it was not that big, not much of an issue. I wish they kind of, again, would got on behind the blue curtain, we could fix them and got that thing straightened out. But it's a BS piece of legislation. It doesn't have any real teeth to it. It's window dressing. That's what it is. It's window dressing. And so I wish we would have had that mental health component in there, because this is the number one issue facing law enforcement today. And we're horrible at it. We're horrible at fixing this issue. So it's not defined, right? It takes people like me to reach out to Sean and say, hey, look, I gotta get this thing together. And to me as an agency leader, not only does it have to be mental health, it's gotta be physical health, and then we also need to start talking about financial health, because we as cops, when we first get hired, we go buy a truck and a boat. We're automatically put into debt. So, we've got to start talking about this holistic approach. And I don't want to steal your thunder, Sean, but you got to get the family involved in it too, right? We're talking about husbands, wives, kids. I mean, this is a whole 540 degree approach to solve this issue. And I'm going to tell you from a small agency perspective, it's damn tough, because there's not any money for that. I don't have that. I've got people that I know I can reach out to, and I can probably call them a few favors to start this program. There's not a grant funding for this. There's nothing. So the politicians need to get off their rear ends and listen to some of us and start to work on these issues. And I'm telling you, if we can get this push forward, a lot of the problems that the major media shows every day will go away, because it's the mental health and well-being of our people on the street. And we have this idea that we're infallible, that we cannot make mistakes, right? That's the general public's perception of us, and we do. We're humans. We mess stuff up all the time. So, we've got to really push this narrative and get forward with move forward with it, and try to get some of these issues resolved for sure.
To follow up on Jim, and Jim and I had this talk earlier, and I talked to Betsy and you said about it. But we've said it that so the idea is you've got to create a culture of safety for someone to come forward that wants to get help. If it's not there and it's punitive, then they're going to hide it. Why are they going to come forward? And I'm going to get really radical here. And I was flown in to a large agency for the federal government, and we're going to train all their crews for here at the end of the month. But I said, here's my idea. I'm going to bring some really common sense to a complex situation, or what's viewed as complex, and that's pretty radical in this world nowadays. But I said, you're not going to like what I'm going to say, but I said, quit building peer support teams. Because you build peer support teams. So then I asked them, I said, so tell me what the core values of these peer support teams are. What are their policies? When do they transfer? How do they do that? Because we're dealing with internal politics within a department, where in relationships and things like that. So I said, here's what I would like you to do, is I want you to build a family program where a peer support program can communicate effectively in adult life. wrong. Now put the peer support team within there and let them function at a very high efficient level where we don't hide things. And luckily we're watching there because, you know, Jim, we'll have to talk, but we have a solution because we work at the insurance company. You know, how do you create that in a department? So we work like with the city of Irving and Waco and many others, but Irving, we created such a manner where, you know, you come forward and you need that acute care level of help, which is, you know, treatment. Your deductible's waived, your out-of-pocket's waived, it's automatic 30 days off with pay and with the blessing of the fire chief and police chief. That's pretty cool to me. What they say is, hey, we're excited you're going to give help. We'll see you in 30 days. We can't wait for you to get back. Those are the kind of environments that have got to be created so people can get the help that they not only deserve, it's the help that you earned.
And you're 100% correct. And I'm just going to, real quick, when I started at this agency, we had an officer with a significant addiction issue with alcohol. And my agency had never dealt with it, right? Their measured fix-it was what traditionally we did. Oh, you got to go. Right, so we got rid of it. So he really, there was no reason to fire, but we needed to get the person help in. And I remember having these conversations with my leaders and saying, this is what needs to get done. And they, you know, their heads were spinning. They're like, what? We're going to, and I said, yes, we can save him and fix him and do the things that get him the help that he needs. And we did it two or three times, rehab, but nothing was defined. That was the issue. My agency is not the only one that doesn't have it defined because there are so many of us that are out there agency-wise that just, you know, the traditional method was just to get rid of them rather than help them. So, you know, it's great. I love that Irving does that. And you and I are going to connect after this and we're going to get some stuff moving because I've got some pretty good ideas on what we need to get done, at least for my group.
Let me do this rubber right here because I got to bring this person in. Because we've now outlined that there's a problem, and we're kind of giving our solutions that we're going, and we're right on point. But right now, I want to speak to the young people that are in this job, the people that don't even know why the hell they took the job, the ones that think they're super men and women, and this doesn't matter to them. And like Sean said, I'm not a big advocate of these peer support groups to be handling these type incidents. I'm just not. For Stan, I'm not going to go sit in a room with a bunch of officers' wives and officers and talk about Stan's personal problems. Because in police departments, guess what? That's going to spread around. So you might as well have just stood up and roll call and said it. But rather than me say it, I'm so honored and privileged to have this young lady here today. And she's going to get the floor to talk about what she went through, not read, but what somebody told her. And we're going to give her this time and this voice. And then, Claire, when you're done, I really want you and Betsy to dialogue, take the time and dialogue. The reason why we oftentimes consciously do these problems from a male perspective. And the dynamic of the female officer who everybody wants to screw coming right out of the academy, let's just be real about it. Then you're not man enough to do this part of the job. Then you must be gay because you're too manly. All this shit that y'all have to carry, that even policing doesn't want to talk about it. When we define this problem and we talk about the stresses in the job and we as men can say what we went through, nobody wants to turn the page and get to your page. So, Claire, tell your story. And then I want you and Betsy to take the time you need to bond and educate all of us. And good morning, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Stan. Good morning, everybody. Like Stan mentioned earlier, I was a police officer at the city of Waco. I did go through a shooting on March 1st of 2019 in the city of Waco. Afterwards, I went to California for one rehabilitation center for 1 month, 30 days, through Sean Riley. And he put me in one place. It wasn't a great thing. Now, the reason was because, actually, Sean spoke to the fact that there are addicts sitting right next to officers. When I went back and reported that to my department, they moved me to another place where it was more first responder based. Hearing Sean's side now, it actually makes sense why you did that, to integrate the officers with right there along with people with addictions, because you do want to build that bond, build that trust between those individuals that there wasn't before. Not saying obviously there wasn't in my situation, but I actually made several friends in that rehabilitation center that I didn't expect that I would ever. I made several friends in both, but I keep up with more of my friends with addictions than I do with my police officer friends. And why is that? Why are they checking in on me and not officers that I previously worked with or knew that I went through a shooting? And then to speak to Stan's point as far as talking to your peers within this police department, I wanted to say that as a young officer coming in, yes, you have nice guys like Stan that just, you know, want to say hi and don't want to screw you. But, you know, maybe they want to have more of a fatherly figure. Well, unfortunately, for young women out there, Betsy, I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but it's just not the case. There's not that many men that want to be fatherly figures to a younger woman. They would rather screw them. And that's just, it is what it is. And I hate that, but it's the truth. I, you know, went around the rumor mill and heard things. But whenever you hear those kind of things and then you go through a shooting and that's your peer support group, absolutely not. I don't want to go talk to them. And like Officer Devlin suggested before, maybe bringing more of a family aspect in. Or, I'm sorry, I think Sean mentioned that. Bringing more of a family aspect in, because my mom never received help. I lived with my mom at the time. I think I just moved out about a month prior to our shooting, but it took a toll on my mother. I mean, imagine her, you know, 21-year-old daughter going to work every day with a, you know, a duty belt on and a gun strapped to her hip and saying, you know, do this, do that, and who knows what's going to happen. And, you know, I'm going out all hours of the night doing that, and she has no idea. So whenever I go through a shooting and I have to call my own mother and say, hey, Mom, don't freak out. I need you to come up to the police department. I need to talk to you. I got into a shooting, but I'm okay. Yeah, that's pretty scary for a mother to hear. And she has to drive herself up there and then, you know, talk to me for however long, talk to all these officers that want to offer, you know, that say, we want to help you and, you know, Claire's the best and we appreciate her so much for serving our community. But where's her help after that? I mean, she maybe had a few officers reach out to her here and there, but other than that, where's her mental health? I mean, does she just have to deal with it? And then when I got sent off to California for the rehabilitation program, you know, I got a lot. I learned a lot. I got to meet lots of people. I did sound bowls. I did yoga. I got all kinds of treatment and lots of group therapy, things that really helped me. I still have PTSD. But it helped as an individual officer. So that's kind of what I went through. Stan, did you have anything else you wanted me to add?
You know, let me ask you this, Claire, Let me ask you this, and if you don't want to talk about it, you don't have to. But, you know, I think America sees TV shows, and they think we shoot somebody, and the sergeant says, oh, take 2 weeks off, and you just go home and everything's hunky-dory. You move around the public, and nobody ever bothers you. You're not, you know, sometimes in departments, the rumor mill can be worse than the public. And you were young. I mean, I call you my baby girl, but you're a police baby. And all of this crap was on your shoulders. That's one of the reasons why I'm so impressed by you, to take all of that on your shoulders and not have all these people that you can reach out to. And yet you handled it. You did it. And what I love is that you reevaluated things and you said, this job is not for me. For whatever reason, you made that decision. You were smart enough to say, I'm not happy here. It's not that I don't want to help people, but I can't deal with what I've seen. And I oftentimes say in policing, I found it out after 22 years when I spoke up about police brutality. Nothing against my department, but when I spoke up, you really come into this sense when these types of things happen, who's really been in your corner and who hasn't been. But, you know, I think I would really like to hear from Betsy on this, because I think a lot of things that you've seen, she's seen and overcome, and you're like-minded that way, because a lot of female officers will hear this. And I want them to stop being willing victims just to be blue.
Well, I started on the job in 1980 in the Chicago suburbs. And, you know, one of my first sergeants, the first thing he told me was that, hey, I don't believe I brought the police work. You know, and I was 21, you know, just 2 weeks out of college. I was very naive, never lived in a city before. And so, yeah, it was very different. And the same with women. And now I train thousands of women cops. I have classes just for women. And then, you know, I do regular classes as well, office survival leadership, all that. But I have been studying now for several decades just how different men and women are in the way our brains function, in the way our bodies function. And we don't do a good job of addressing that in law enforcement. So, Claire, when you're involved in a shooting, your brain actually processes that whole thing very differently. What I want every man to know about women, I want women to know this about themselves, is that because of the way our brain functions, we bring emotion to literally everything that happens to us, to every decision that we make. Men are much better at kind of boxing things up, pushing things aside. Women are not good at that. So we bring a lot of emotion, and this doesn't mean that I'm driving around in my patrol car weeping and this and that. It doesn't mean we're weak, but it just means that our brain is constantly processing emotion that is connected to every tactical decision we make, every decision we make about victims or suspects or any interrogation we do. It's exhausting to be in the brain of a woman cop. Let me just tell you that. I'm sure Claire can attest to that. Because we're just constantly on. And we don't address that in law enforcement. So here she is, a young woman, gets involved in a deadly force incident. And like most situations, you know, at first everybody's there, yeah, you're the best. We're behind you. You're a girl. Hugs, kisses. Know all that stuff, and then very quickly things change. And I've talked to a lot of women involved in deadly force incidents, and the rumors start. And the well, she should have done this, she should have done that. Mm-hmm. You know, I would have done this. I knew. You know, I told her we shouldn't have women in police work. Mm-hmm. And Claire, I'm sure you can talk about this. It's exhausting. Right? And so now you have to, process all that yourself. Then your mom has to process it, because here you are, you know, you don't have a significant other at that time. You're living with your mom. You know, when I was your age, I hid everything I did for a living from my parents. I didn't talk to them about it because I didn't think they could handle it. Your mom's watching. Your mom's got a front row seat. And we talk about the family. When we talk about family, we tend to talk about, you know, spouse, partner, kids, things like that. But I have talked to a lot of police parents who begin to have issues of their own. And now in today's atmosphere, when we're called racist, we're called killers, we're called this, that, we're called unnecessary, it's difficult for us, but it's difficult for our parents as well. So now we circle back to the issue of police officer mental health. But not just officers involved in critical incidents, not just officers involved in deadly force, but also because it starts to, you know, and it's been 22 years. It just wears you out. And we don't talk about that enough. But I also want to say one thing. I get 29 years on the job, mid-sized suburban agency. I did love every damn day I was there. I don't want to encourage, discourage people from choosing this profession. But we need to do a better job of preparing. And Claire, when you were in the academy, how much mental health training did you get? How much discussion of your own mental health did you get?
You know, Betsy, and that's what I want to say. I don't want to discourage anyone from joining a police department of their own, especially women, because there needs to be more women. I just realized that it just wasn't going to be me. I got into it thinking that it would be, and gone through the academy. We didn't talk much about mental health. I remember watching more old tapes of, like, you know, whatever shooting or whatever incident happened here. I remember, you know, reliving other officers, you know, greatest dreams in the academy more than talking about mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. And my husband, for those of you who don't know, I married to my police officer's London fan, a guy named J.D. I am Mrs. And so Dave Smith, my husband, you know, was with Arizona GPS. And so decades ago, when he was running the police academy, he basically had to beg to get a few hours of mental health training to his recruits in the 80s. He was fortunate enough to bring in a guy named Kevin Gilmartin, who wrote the book Emotional Threat for Law Enforcement. But in that academy class, Dr. Gilmartin came in, and he did a class for the recruits called It's All Bullshit and Everyone's an Asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And if, which, of course, he had to change to Emotional Survival. And your offer to them, you know, it's all bullshit and everyone's an asshole. But that really, that was kind of the first of a discussion of police officer mental health, but I think that we have gotten so far away from that in our academy because we have so much else that we have to shove down our recruits' throats, you know, and we've got to talk about de-escalation and implicit bias and this and that and what's your preferred pronoun and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about everybody else. You know, we can't talk about our own mental health. We got to change that too.
You know, let me ask this before I go to Joe, because Joe's been in the shooting, and I want to get his input, you know, in on this. But I think the thing that I want people to go away from this, and, you know, we're all talking, and what I want them to really understand is that I know some of you think you know police. I know you think you understand what we do. I know what you're going to say. I know what some of you are thinking. My husband's a cop. My wife is a cop. My brother's a cop. So therefore, I am an expert. I'm here to tell you, no, you don't know. You don't know Jack. Because there is 80% of our day, 80%. I do not come home and talk to my wife about it. She didn't need to know. You don't want to know. Most of you can't even take a two-hour movie you paid to go see after watching the previews, and you can't sleep for a week, and you're on Facebook. Oh, this was so horrible. I couldn't sleep after watching. Live it. Come in the house smelling like a dead body, and then have your wife ask you, what's that smell? How do you go home and just go up to your room and shut the door, and right now I don't want to deal with nobody because I just dealt with a 3-year-old sodomized or a whole family beheaded in a car accident or whatever the case may be? These are things you can't undo them. You can't erase them. They are a part of you. They're going to be with you to the day you go in the dirt. And every time you see a post or a face, it's going to take you back 10, 15, or 20 years to that event. That is the part of policing that nobody wants to understand. Not because I'll say society doesn't want to understand. It's because there have not been programs and instruments in place for officers to feel like, I'm not a hero, I'm human. See, we don't get to be both. You can't be hero today and human tomorrow. Nobody loves me. Just be a human. And so we have been built up to this immortal status so long that, guess what? We've begun to believe the lie. So therefore, if we don't look hurt, our chiefs and city managers and mayors and senators and congresspeople are not going to react to our feelings. That is why we are killing ourselves. Officers are not killing themselves because of the calls on the street. They are killing themselves because they're tired of politics. They're tired of bullshit. They're tired of the pressures in the job. They're tired of being disrespected out in the community. Everybody's thrown into the basket of one, as Betsy said. Because some of y'all that are listening, and we're listening, you're too damn lazy to do some damn homework and find out about that officer we're talking about and deal with that officer. Yes, we got some racist cops in this profession that need to go. Yes, we got some power mongers that need to go. But we got, guess what? Those are not the ones committing suicide. The ones committing suicide are the good ones, the ones who gave a damn, who go home and balance their bills and try to do the best and work, hello somebody, 2 and 3 part-time jobs. Not to buy that fishing boat, but to pay the light bill. Because the city doesn't pay them enough, but they give a damn enough to go in there every day and do that damn job. This pisses me off when the police unions ought to be talking like I'm talking, like Betsy's talking, like Joe is going to talk about, like Sean is going to talk about, the chief. I'm sick and tired of no more everyday people in this country having to carry the burden and carry the microphone, which, by the way, we never get. That's why we do shows like this, where we'll take it. And guess what? They'll be listening to us tomorrow. That is hard talk. Let me get off the soapbox. Joe, you went through a shooting. And I know, Joe, you're Joe. You're that personality here. I love you, brother, but I'm going to ask you to do something for me and for all the listeners. Go into Joe's emotions. How Joe felt.
No, I can tell you this. My shooting actually made me a better supervisor. Let me tell you why. When I got into my shooting, the arriving sergeant didn't ask how I was doing. First thing he said was, "What the fuck did you do?" That's a quote. I learned from then on that was not how I was going to approach my officers. He says, "What the fuck did you do? And give me your gun." I'm like, shit, you might get the gun in a second, you motherfucker, if you don't get back. You know, that's what's wrong with me. That's the truth. But from then on, when I arrived on the shoot, the first thing I did was I asked my officer, "How are you doing? Can we talk on the side?" And at that point, as a detective, I'd get in the car with him and take him or her to a hospital. I wouldn't let the FOP talk to him. I did not let the units talk to him. I didn't let the executives talk to him. I took them to see them. And that's the way I operated from then on. I refused to, and I could have been fired, and probably should have, because I did violate rules and regs. And the rules and regs said that I should make them do X and Y in a certain way, and I didn't do that. As I went through my career as a trainer, I continued to have my other detectives trained the way I wanted them to do it. And to this day, I haven't lost a detective based on some of the training I gave. But that is a combination of everybody on this panel. I had to live vicariously. Everybody on this panel, I'm you and you're me. That's the reality of the situation. Forgive me, I get a little choked up sometimes. Because they asked me before they had mental health. No one asked me how did I feel. And yes, I had to do what Claire did. First thing I had to do was call my mother, who was dying at the time. I said, "Listen, the system will call you. What's going on, son?" And they look, God, something just happened. So I had to wind up making my notifications before the department mail, which would send my family off. So I had to call my wife, my sister, my mother. And even to this day, some of those systems are still not correct. Now, let's go back to the very base point. How do we correct this? Let me say this to everybody that's listening. Police law enforcement, have been very fortunate. We have not had this action call going postal. We have been very fortunate in this country not to have any of those incidents yet. But are we crying for it? Goddamn right we are. Goddamn right we are.
I mean, we're talking about people with big guns, fucked up attitudes, and bad, bad management. Now, let's go back to a very basic point. Let's talk about the managers of this mishmash. In our system, not everyone that should be a supervisor is. Would everybody agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So if you've got bad leadership, you're passing bad information. And I think that's the problem we have with the majority of these firms. We need the best. We need the players. Even John Isidore and Chief and even Sean. I mean, it would be great if we all could, maybe we should collaborate on a book on the mental health of the police. But something has got to be done. It's got to be done.
You know, Joe,
you talked about the hero syndrome. Yeah, I used to have an S on my chest and I used to jump through, you know, leap tall buildings at the same of a bomb. Now I'm hardly lucky to walk up a step except for my next step.
Let me do this real quick, Joe, before I go to Claire. Claire raised her hand. You could always tell young people, they're so used to Zoom meetings, they're like, you know. Let's add another dynamic to this. Because if we're going to go down this rabbit hole, let's go all the way down this hole. Let's get to the core of some of these officers who commit suicide. What are the commonalities? The community loved them. They love the community. Not a segment of it. They love that community. And when you get these officers who go, yes, this drug dealer was shot. Yes, this gang member was shot. Yes, does the department. And I'm not going to give the citizens a pass because you're out there every day. You know where the police are going. You know what cars we're driving. You know everything you're doing. When that officer that you knew John, Jim, Bob, Pookie, whatever name you want to give him, when that officer could walk in your community and police it the way you wanted, where his presence or her presence was not a disturbance to the community, it was a respect, acceptance, a welcome addition to the community, even by those doing wrong. And that officer is there, and I've had this happen two occasions to me. It's out there working that drive-by, that murder, that drug-related shooting. Yeah, drug guy, bad guy. But everybody knows. From my situation, Stan lives here. Stan knew that kid X amount of years. I got to process that scene. This ain't TV. Charge, I got to go home. I need the rest of the month off. That's bullshit. Now, I don't care what he was to us from a legal standpoint. I know at that point I'm processing the scene. I'm trying to keep my personal out of it and stay professional, but I'm looking down at a kid that respected me. I don't care what he thought about police. I don't care what he thought about anything other than how this person treated me. And you stand there and you process that. And you go home and you try to make sense out of it. Because you go back to the department and everybody's talking about how thankful they are that this guy is dead. Not even considering how much time you spend in that neighborhood or that you live in that neighborhood and that you knew this kid who made bad decisions. Those things add up. There's only three types of people in this world. Those that are caught, those that are caught up, and those that haven't been caught yet. All of us are one of them. Most of us are two. Some of us are three. And so that's an avenue of your good officers that are committing suicide who can walk up to that prostitute and have a conversation or that street corner drug dealer and have a conversation. Guess what else they can do? They can solve cases because they know what's going on in that community. They're going to go home. They're not going to be shot by a citizen. Why? Because those citizens know that person in the community. Let me get off. Claire, I saw you had your little hand up.
Yeah, Stan, I guess I was going a little bit down more of the rabbit hole that Joe was going down, but I did want to kind of change the subject just a little bit as far as telling my story, because I know that was something that Stan kind of wanted me more to go in depth of. And I'd like to share it personally because I think it's something that needs to be shared, that needs to be talked about, and I personally don't know if an officer that has gone on some live media and shared their actual, like an actual story of full of emotion and trauma and everything involved, and I'd like to do that now if I could.
Go ahead. Absolutely.
On the date, because my full name is up here, so I'm just, you know, anybody can look up whatever they want to. If there's articles, all you got to do is Google my name. I'm not proud of the incident. It happened. It definitely shaped who I am today and what I want to do, which I'll get to as well. But on March 1st of 2019, I got a call, and it was pretty much came over the radio as just some sort of disturbance. It was pretty almost nothing. It didn't seem like anything big. And there were very little notes, case notes that were put in that you checked, you know, on your way to the scene. I was the only one out of my district that was free at the time, so I got the call by myself, and then somebody was sent out of district to come as my backup. So as you can imagine, that was pretty far out. So I went by myself, parked a ways off, and, you know, kind of assessed the situation, tried to stay a little bit out of the way, you know, so I didn't get pulled into it by myself. That's just protocol. That's what you do. At least that's what I was taught to do by some of the older officers. Well, I got approached by a gentleman that said, hey, there's something going on over there. So then I just got pulled into it by myself. I radioed for backup. They were still a ways off. It obviously just wasn't coming, so I had to do something. I wasn't just going to sit there and hide and say, well, sorry, I got to wait for my backup. So I went. So I got back in my car, fired it up, and this guy, that one of the guys that ran up to me said, he said something along the lines of, I think somebody's trying to kill somebody over there. And so, of course, yeah, I'm right into action. And like Betsy said, your action and emotion, everything's going 100%. And so I got behind the car, whipped around the corner, there it is, and this guy turned around, covered in blood, had a knife in his hand. He had, you know, like, it was, you know, it was bad. And I was within maybe two car lengths away from this guy, and I'm on him, I'm ready, and I'm like, back up, hold on, let's talk. And I'm trying to talk him down, and he's just not budging. He's not giving it up, and he's starting to take more of an aggressive stance towards me. And when I approached him, at first he was kicking the doors and trying to, like, seem like he was trying to get in. When I grabbed his attention, that's when I tried to talk him down, and it was not happening. And that's when I had to draw down on him. I, you know, had announced who I was. So his eyes got real wide, and I remember his face. I remember everything about it. Every time I see a piece of clothing, that I know what he was wearing. I remember what he was wearing. I remember that he was wearing a plaid shirt with, you know, like blue and orange on it. I can remember exactly what the guy was wearing, exactly what he looked like. And I have, you know, these flashbacks of it. And I'm not sure exactly what's going on. I don't know what's going on. It's confusing. So then what happened next was he just took off running, and the guy that had originally told me my attention to go over there, he stepped in and had tackled the guy before I was able to switch to a taser, like do anything else. And this guy with the knife was trying to get into somebody else's car, and in response to that, this original guy that I was talking to tackled him onto the ground, and then this original guy with the knife, the suspect, started stabbing this individual. And that's when I had to pull the trigger. I mean, there was nothing else. I mean, I could hear it happening. I could hear the knife going into this man's side. I could hear it, and I still hear it. And that is not talked about, and it needs to be. Mm-hmm. It needs to be.
Betsy, can you, by all means, please.
Well, here's what I want to say. What breaks my heart to literally hundreds and hundreds of police officers involved in deadly force shootings. But we, the law enforcement community, we don't get out there together and hear each other's interviews, mm-hmm. see each other's incidents. So here we have a young police officer involved in a shooting, and I can't tell you how many women I have talked to say the same thing. In shootings, they're like, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only one who ever had to deal with this. I thought I was the only one who had to pull the trigger. There's thousands of us out there, that thousands of you guys that have had to do this. And here we are. We get so isolated mm-hmm. in our own situation mm-hmm. and in our own community where she's thinking, this is, I'm it. And that makes me so angry. And it's because we, for some reason, when a lot of times when an officer successfully concedes their own shooting situation, they just kind of want to go back to work and not deal with it. You know, not, I don't want to talk about it anymore. This is where we need to reach out to each other. This is where I do think, Sean, the importance of peer support is just to have help say, I know what that feels like. I just interviewed a deputy last week who talked about, I mean, it's been a similar situation prior to yours where it was just kind of a nonsense at first, and then it just went, of course, it all went to hell. And he talked about just, of course, the barrel of that gun that was this big, the gun that is you know, and he sees the bullet come out, and he sees his bullet coming out. And that's very common. And Claire, I just want to say this personally, because you talk about why I'm not proud of this. That's bullshit. You'd be proud of the fact that you had a badge and a gun on, you went to a call, you went in by yourself, and you were involved in a situation that most human beings are never going to even see.
Amen.
Much less be in the middle of it. Don't you ever say again, I'm not
Amen.
Proud. Amen. Proud of you and what you did and that old thing you took and the fact that you walked into that situation in your community alone.
I'm absolutely there. There's one thing that Claire came to a realization. I don't know if she realized that. She goes, hey, I understand now why Sean put me where he did. And it wasn't to just tell me what she's working through that. I made him proud. So Betsy's proud, and we're all proud. She did that shooting, but she took responsibility for her own health, her own mental health, mm-hmm. to go forward. But the idea was, I didn't need her to be a better cop. I didn't need her to go to treatment to be a better cop. I need Claire to go to treatment to be a better Claire.
Amen.
And I think, Jim, that's the thing that's missing when you talk about IACP and everything. Our peer support, I'm not doubting any of that. We need it all. But the reality is that they stuck these chiefs in a box of one size fits all mm-hmm. when you're dealing with the human brain. And my brain is different than Claire's, but you want it treated the same way with policy. Well, guess what? That's not how it works in the real world, and you're trying to apply it. So, Claire, phenomenal that you came to that conclusion. There was a reason behind it. Didn't make sense at the time, but it makes sense. And I'm more proud of that. She took responsibility for her own mental health. People don't do that. A lot of people don't. And she did.
And you know, before I go to you, Chief, just real quick to Sean's point, I just want to say, you know, because Betsy talked earlier and she said about, you know, women bring emotion and this and that there. And I want the audience to understand this and the listeners to understand. Right now, Betsy's on with Joe and me and the Chief and we're and Claire, we're in cop mindset over here. So we kind of talk in a different language, but I want y'all to understand for Stan, and this is Stan's opinion, you know, I agree 1,000% with her, but I don't see that as a bad thing, and I don't see it as a bad thing because when you bring all that emotion, and she didn't say it was a bad thing, I just don't want the listeners to take it that way, that, oh, women are weak, they bring emotion. When you bring emotion and you bring passion, guess what else you bring? Empathy and understanding. Maybe we wouldn't be getting a hell suit out of us if we brought a little bit more of that. Maybe we wouldn't have to turn everything into a major incident and a hostage standoff if we brought more of that. So maybe our philosophy and our practice of policing needs to take a momentary timeout. in the corner. You don't have necessarily have to put the dunce cap on yet. But let's look at what is working versus upon what we've been doing, because what we've been doing ain't working, folks. It ain't working. So I just wanted to do that. Go ahead real quick, Joe, and I want to get to the Chief.
Let me say this to Betsy and Claire. Mm-hmm. My shooting, the guy that tried to shoot me was 18 years old. And I can tell you, I actually saw the muzzle blast. I mean, I could see the bullet in slow motion. I could, in real time, I'm going, what the fuck just happened?
Mm-hmm.
I had my 40, at the time I was carrying a 45 and a 9mm. I had my 45 up. I was getting ready to blow this fucking brains out. But something said, don't kill him. And I didn't. This young man, and before we had this, what we call now, I went back to work the next day. This guy's mother came up to me and said, officer, in true form, officer, thank you for not killing him because he deserved to die. That's what his mother said. But I came back to work the next day exactly because of what Sam was talking about. I could not be seen as being weak. I could not be seen as caving into the gang. Probably was wrong on my part, but the department at that time did not have what it has in place to this day. And thank God we do have something in place. Thank God that you got help. Because I've actually gone, and I still, believe it or not, I still have nightmares. And this is something I've never told anybody this, but I'm telling you, I still have nightmares. Did I do the right thing? This point yet. But I will tell anybody, you have to answer to whatever you call your God, or whatever you want to call that entity in your space. And you did the right thing and you should be proud of yourself.
Joe, before I go to Izzy and the Chief, and I'm going to say this. I called Claire last minute. And you don't get officers who will come on and talk about themselves and how they felt like she did. And you damn sure won't get it from somebody as young as she does. So she gets crazy up for me. Like I said, when I say that's my baby girl, that's like my daughter. And I, you know, what hurt me the most, watching her go through what she did, it was before I left. Part of it even to this day, and I call her and she and I stay in touch and I talk. I feel bad that I'm not there with her. But she knows she can always call me. We talked last night, and she said something to me. She said, please always remain in my life. Please always remain close to me. Had it not been for policing, Claire would never have even known me. And it's not, I didn't have no profound wisdom. Stan is not the smartest, you know, person out there walking around. But I know enough to listen to when God tells me this one here. Out of everybody in her academy, she'll tell you, I walk by them in the hall, good morning, and that's it. I'm going to my car or going home. That one there. And when she would start to talk to me, things that she's not going to talk about here, and I'm not going to talk about it, of what she went through and how she felt. And how, and this is what hurt me, how alone she felt. She said it. Betsy said it. Everybody's in your corner in the beginning. Great shoot. And we're not saying great that you killed somebody. We're saying you did your job. Where were all these people? And I'm not knocking Waco PD. I'm knocking people in police shootings, period. You don't do your research. You jump on Facebook. You think you know, and you don't know. And to the officers who work with these other officers who get involved in these incidents, but because you vote politically different, you don't give a damn about it. That's a dysfunctional family. And this lady, oh, my God. The Zoom just cut out. Okay, so everybody back. Okay. Whew.
Well, I thought I was going to mention, I think, you know, the importance, some of the importance of, for the listeners, the importance of mental health for the police officers. But after I went to California, I came back and like Sean said, I did have to take rein on my own mental health. And I had to come to the conclusion that I am a human being. I'm not being trained to just come back to policing. I'm trying to come back to being a human being again. So what I've Smith, and that's what I'm doing now. After I left policing, I decided to go back to school and get my graduate degree in counseling so that I can help police officers that were in my position to, you know, get back out on the street and go do a better job than they did before with people like Sean's help that would be able to help officers be in those situations where they are able to make friends with people with addiction issues, drinking issues, anything. Just being more involved in a different community than you maybe you grew up with, maybe you whatever. Just putting yourself out there and reinventing the world of policing.
Amen. Big John, what do you think, bro? You're the civilian in the room right now. In a world of, right now, you're in a world of cops, bro. I really want to hear your input on what you've heard so far.
Wow. Great show, great guests. We got great experts on this show. I have several questions. Some are, one is direct to Betsy, and you kind of touched on it, Stan, and I'm going to give you guys one of my questions, and then you can answer. My first question would be, Betsy touched on the pent up emotions, and like Stan, I believe that's a dangerous thing for male officers to have pent up emotions, and maybe that's the reason why you see so much aggression and traffic stops and nonviolent situations like breach of peace turns violent, where cops hitting someone, striking someone, because they got so much pent-up aggression, where women who express themselves, who are emotional, those things don't say themselves up in them. So I'm going to bring that back for you to answer with regards to that. And I guess my next question would be to Brother Sean, which is, how has the Code of Blue affected officers' mindset? When we talk about dealing with mental health issues, you sign up as a young cop, like Sister, I believe her name is Claire, right? She signs up as a young cop. She comes in and wanting to do the right thing. And you have this code of blue. And she's seeing all this stuff going on around her. And she wants to do the right thing. But if she does do the right thing, she's going to be ostracized. She's going to be talked about. How would that play into someone's life when they want to do the right thing and they're afraid to do the right thing because now she's going to be like an outsider within that code of blue? And then the last question, I guess, would be to anyone on the panel is, I'm sitting here thinking about, especially like Stan, I know you work the neighborhood, and you watch the kid grow up, he was 9 years old, and he used to bring him home to his mother or grandmother, and now at 14, 15, he's killed, and you have to go to that same grandmother whose son you used to bring home. How do you expect a cop not to have some type of mental health issues? When he helped raise this kid, he started to keep this kid on the straight and now, how do you get that cop? And I do have one last question, it wasn't clear. And that was, or Joe, what happens when, and I guess it's more so you, Joe, because you're still in law enforcement, but, okay, so now this is a shoot, and you're back in the streets, and you got all this stuff that's weighing on you, and you're approached with another situation similar to that one. Do you hesitate? Do you freeze in that situation because you don't want to go through the nightmares that Claire is talking about? How do you get that cop the real help that he needs so that he may effectively do his job if ever faced with that same situation? And those are my four questions.
Okay, let's do this, John. Now, we got to break them down. That's an awful lot that came out real quick. But let's do this. Go to your first one, And you got the floor, bro. We ain't rushing here. We're going to be thorough. You got the floor. Go to your first one. Say who you want to answer, and let's get – because I they're good questions, and I want to make sure we address them.
Betsy, you got a smile on her face like she already has her answer. So let's start with Betsy.
Yeah, John, going back to talking about youth officers, especially male officers, have pent-up aggression because of holding down their emotions. So let me go at it from a scientific standpoint. Again, looking at the male and female brain and how our brains function differently when we're in those situations. And Women Council will tell you this a lot. Women tend to be better at negotiating with people, calming people down, especially men, because again, that's the way our brain works. And Claire, you've probably had this happen where you were on a traffic stop or an arrest or a domestic or whatever, and you've got everything all calmed down, everybody's all, you guys are suspects ready to get into handcuffs, and a male officer pulls up, being helpful, being your backup, walks right up, and boom, we're rolling around on the ground. All of a sudden, what the hell is just happening? Yes, a lot of times, male to male, so male suspect to male police officer, their brains are just going to do different things. They're going to react differently. There's also cultural issues, social issues, all that. So, John, back to your original question. Do bodily police men have a lot of pent-up emotion and all that? And that's what makes them aggressive. No, I believe that every police officer out there, especially in today's atmosphere, but again, going back, 30, 40 years, understand that the minute that we're in the police academy and then we get out and go to field training, we are being taught that people want to hurt us, people want to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
We're taught that any situation can, go to hell in a handbasket.
Yep.
Immediately. So think about that, the cops in the panel can weigh in. That every traffic stop you make, you start to walk up, even, with the mom and with a minivan with eight kids in it, what are you waiting for? You're waiting to get shot. You're waiting to get run over.
Amen.
Having to control yourself and yet keep yourself safe does take a toll, and you've got to learn to manage it. So I do not believe, and again, I've talked to thousands and thousands of police officers around this country and frankly around the world and not especially international stuff. And I don't find that most police officers are overly aggressive. But what we are, and Kevin Gilmore talks about this and a lot, that hypervigilant biological roller coaster, where we're just so on all the time. And why are we so on all the time? Because I want to go home to my family too. I don't want to get into a shooting. I don't want to get run over. I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to be rolling around on the ground with a suspect or one of my citizens or whatever. So we have to have a different mentality, and if we don't manage that, and there's a lot of ways to manage it,
mm-hmm.
if we don't manage it, then we're going to have problems.
There you go.
She just nailed that one right there about the fence. We're just talking about this. Here at this conference, and Dr. Keith Marshall says it's not about being pent up, it's about how we're conditioned on male and female, and we're conditioned as males, we're all told, you don't cry, you're a man, you don't cry when you grow up, or I'll give you something to cry about, right? That's how we're doing. So we got to reframe that. It's like, no, I don't want to talk about it. No, you have a responsibility to talk about it and be a healthy human being. That's your responsibility to do it. So we need to reframe and change the dynamics of what that looks like.
And Sean, if I can inject real quick into that, because this I can't let the show go by without saying it. I got to put this in there. And folks can get uncomfortable about it, but I'm going to put it in. What Bessie just said is exactly right. If I can sum it up, we come into policing as normal people, and we are trained to be afraid and uncomfortable. Not safe. There's nothing wrong with being safe, but we are trained to be afraid of anything that is different from our norm or the norm that we are re-educated to believe. And sometimes in that, the American narrative is, that black is bad. I'm not saying that white, the white guy with the long hair and tattoos is bad. Anything that makes us feel uncomfortable for whatever socioeconomic or sociopolitical reason it's out there, we react to it. That is what leads up to these losses. Everybody, it's not all about racism. It's about an indoctrination, oftentimes, where we teach people, I'm going to finish my point, Joe, I'll let you on. But people that are afraid of anything, that is different. We think normal people who never carried a flashlight, walking up to their house or walking to the movie theater, but now what's the first thing officers do when they come out of the academy on a midnight shift? Just walking up to a barking dog. Flashlight comes out, something's going to jump out the bushes and get me. And when it gets me, what have I been trained to do? Go ahead, Joe.
I can't agree totally with all that. And let me tell you why. As a black officer, I will tell you, most of what you just said was correct. A lot of it was wrong. Black officers do have pent-up because you do have the theory of blue. And we know that there's black and blue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will guarantee you where Sean is at his conference, go in there and look at the audience. Guarantee you it's overwhelmingly white males.
Mm-hmm.
I will also tell you this. Pent-up hostilities, pent-up aggressions, shit, yeah. There's not a policeman with a sock that isn't on edge. You're supposed to be on edge. You're trained to be on edge because you're looking for the edge. So that's not necessarily true.
But I would say sometimes we create the edge.
You didn't let me finish.
Go ahead.
The point is this. Are there situations where there, of course, his question was, are policemen on edge? Yes. Are they broken down by racial category? Yes. The problem is that this career field has not been dissected to the point that they can talk about that or are willing to talk
about.
Think about this. Let me tell you this. Why is it that more black officers are killed off duty by their counterparts than white officers?
There you go. My point.
Getting killed in uniform, the black officers. Those are facts. Not there anyone's challenge.
And that proves my point.
There is an edge. And there are some bits of hostility. When you make a traffic stop, and it has to be black or white, you have to be on this because you don't know. You don't know if that trunk's going to pop open. You don't know who's in the back seat. And those things do come to your psyche. Because you want to go home with your family.
Right. I agree, Joe, but let me say this.
Do black officers have it more so than anyone else? I say we do.
I agree. And I'll say this. When we use the term on edge, that's a police term, and we all know what that means. And I'm not knocking that term. But when we say to the civilian community that is now listening to us, on edge, what does on edge mean? On the verge. So I say, be cognizant of your surroundings. Be suspicious of your surroundings. You can be careful. You can do all these other things. But sometimes when you become so on edge that it shows in what you do for no reason, it goes the wrong way. Come on, Claire.
Yeah. So I wanted to speak to that because I agree with Joe. I think that there is pent-up emotion, pent-up anger, pent-up anything, whether it's at home or whether you bring it to work, whether it's just from the last call, I think it's pent-up. I think that is the issue. Because we don't know who to talk to. We don't know who to talk to because we can't bring it home to our family. We don't want to put it on their shoulders. We can't talk to our neighbors because we don't want to put it on their shoulders or our friends. And we can't talk to our fellow officers because they're going to see us as weak, especially as a female officer, because you're already seen as weak as it is. But then the issue is to really bring it all together, I think, for John is to say maybe there is. Maybe there's not with some people. But counseling and integrating that into police departments is the way to go. because regardless if there is or isn't, if there's an option, which is why I want to do what I want to do, if there's an option to see a counselor, to give that individual the help that they need, whether there's pent-up aggression or anger between calls, whatever it is, if you speak to a therapist once a week, then you don't have to carry that pent-up emotion. So you don't have to go from call to call.
Amen.
And be angry, upset. And that goes for men or for women.
You know what, maybe I'm way out of the line here, but I'm going to have to push back a little bit on this just because, you know, at the end of the day, who's responsible for their own mental health? Who's responsible for the pent up? Yeah. So if I pen up, then maybe it's incumbent upon me. And then the other portion of this is we also have a responsibility to resource chiefs to provide services for people that get in situations like that. And because I think we need to put the onus back on the officer. It ultimately is your responsibility on what your mental health looks like. And, you know, you can't change my feelings. Only I can change my feelings, and that's what I'm in control of. And so we need to teach those types of things and resource. So I think you're right on the, yeah, there are people, because hell, I was one of those people, right? You know, but there wasn't a resource for me to go out there at that time. And the chief didn't have it, so we're not giving Jim the tools he needs to help me.
Let me let Chief real quick. Go ahead, Chief.
Well, I'm just gonna say that, you know, what I'm hearing, it's the same thing. We're not allowing this idea that I've got to talk to somebody come through. Now I may be a little bit different, but my wife has heard it all. I mean, because there is no counselor. I mean, I have had an officer-involved shooting. I've been through all that. Same thing that everybody talked about. We're not going to get, you know, the rounds come out of the gun. I saw number three, right, in slow motion. My wife knows that. So she is what keeps me pretty much balanced, right, from this point. So we need to change this narrative, this direction. That, you know, and again, I don't like to push it on her, but she's a very strong individual that has the ability to take this information and keep me from spinning out of control. So, you know, when I have these issues as an administrator, it's tenfold now because I'm the boss of everybody. When you come home and you have these issues, because it affects me too, just like it affects the officer. But Sean's right. At the end of the day, we're responsible individually for our mental health, right? So we need to change this idea and get rid of the stigma to not be able to talk about it, to move forward and get this stuff taken care of. And I, Claire, I'm going to say I'm proud of you. I mean, we didn't say it, but Claire was in, I called her a cat. I'm very proud of what she did. I'm very proud of how she's evolved and moved forward and figured out, you know, what it is that she wants to do. So I got kudos for you, young lady. So don't ever get down on yourself. You know, we need to do what she has. What she brought up about, well, what's the mechanism in place at work when we go from stay on call to call? Is there a break period in there? You know, and I know agencies are putting social workers and counselors, they're putting them on staff, but the majority of the law enforcement agencies are not the size of Chicago, right? So that type of funding and or money that provides that person to be there is non-existent. So we need to get change this thing and be look at it from a different lens and put these things in the place of all of our officers. I mean, it doesn't matter the size of the agency, you know, large or small, they all have this issue. It's not, it's not one way. It's everywhere. And again, to go back to, if we can continue to do this with our people, and I'm going to say this, like I've said on, previous programs here, it's not a one-time deal. It's not a one-size-fits-all deal. Once it happens, once we get involved, it's a continual effort as we move forward. You have to check in. You have to come back, right? And it's just as Claire said, yeah, hey, we're here for you. We're going to help you. We're going to do everything, all these things. And that begins to fade away. It happened with me. It's happened with Joe, right? That's something that can't stop. That's something that needs to continue to evolve. And then those individuals, if we bring them forward, right, they get through their traumatic event, then we use those people to help us teach the younger people coming in, and it's a continual effect, right? It continues throughout the program, and it continues to grow and evolve. That's how you create that culture of safety and psychological safety within the agency.
Yep.
Just,
No, let me go real quick. I gotta go to Betsy because right now I'm feeling that beat partner vibe. She's got that beat partner vibe, and I'm feeling it. So come on, Betsy.
I just gotta say, I got this to talk a little bit more about what Sean said. One of the things we gotta do, we're talking, let's sit here talking at the beginning about politicians gotta do this, and police ministers gotta do this. The bottom line is this, and Claire is an example of this. Taking personal responsibility for your own mental health. I don't think we do a good job of talking about that with young police officers or empowering them to do that. It would be great if every cop in the country could have a weekly counseling session with a skilled social worker. That's not going to happen. But you know what? And I did it myself as a young cop. I knew I'm having some issues. I found a counselor, and I went to three of them before I could find one who could even begin to deal with me. And I talked to somebody, and I didn't go through my agency. In fact, I didn't tell my agency.
Right.
But I knew, I could tell, I was going down a bad path. So police officers, one of the things we need to do is, you know, we talk a lot about our physical, and we cops got to stay in shape. Now, a lot of us don't. The cops need to stay in shape. We need to stay technically sound. And we have got to take responsibility for our own mental health. And if that means money out of our own pocket, well, you know what? Then you don't get the boat. You pay for a counselor. You find a good one. And you find somebody to talk to. And like the chief talked about, that if you have a spouse or a partner that can, I was lucky too. I had one. They can handle it. Then if that's going to be part of your family life, that can make your family life a whole lot better. In fact, we have a class that we teach where we bring in spouses and the cops, and we talk about not just being a warrior cop, but being a warrior family.
Amen.
And that's what we need to do.
Betsy,
Betsy brought it up, but the emotional survival, I can make my wife read it. I try to give it out to everybody I can get my hands. If I can get copies of it, I give it out. That book right there. So if you're law enforcement and you need something to break some of this stuff down, get that book, go to that class, because it is vitally important for your career.
And Chief, before I go to Izzy, I'm going to ask Betsy again. Betsy, you on the Hood Show here. We come straight here. Ain't no sponsors. We just come real because we care about people, not politics or position. And you said something. And I want you to go back and say it again louder for the folks in the back who maybe can't hear you or the folks up in the front who don't want to. You talked about taking responsibility for your own mental health. I will be the first to call out cities, municipalities, police departments, and states who don't consider police wellness. I will. Why? Because I almost dropped the F-bomb. Because we pay tax dollars for you to do your damn job, Republicans and Democrats. We're paying for this, and you don't give a damn about these men and women. You move them around on the chessboard of life like checkers. You don't even give them chess piece status. You make them checkers on the chessboard. You set responsibility for your own mental health. Would you take this? About 30 seconds. Just take some time. And I want you to break that down, not to where the cops can understand it or their wives can understand it, but I want the people out in the community looking at us to understand what you just said.
What we need to do, you know, think about it in this way. We do all kinds of medical things. You know, we get our eyes checked. When you get older, you get, you know, your heart checked and colonoscopy and mammograms if you're a woman and all that. Those are things that nobody tells us to do that we just know that we need to do. When we're talking about mental health, we need to do that same thing. We need to be in touch with ourselves enough to know when we're going down a bad path. I went from 4 years undercover to back to patrol for a short period of time, and then into juvenile where I was doing a lot of kids' sex crimes and things like that. And so I got to a point where, and I was pretty young, I was still in my 20s, that everybody I thought everyone on the planet was a drug dealer and child molester. And so, you know, I recognized it's probably not true, but I need to talk to somebody about it. Here's the bottom line. Here's the emotionally invested in the AC. In fact, Dave Smith said this to me decades ago in a training class. Love this profession. Love what you do. Love your brothers and sisters that you do it with, but do not love the agency, because the agency cannot love you back.
Mm-hmm.
Proud of your agency, be loyal to them, work hard for them, because you're working hard for that community. Don't give your love to that agency. Love your God, your family, your dog, maybe your cat, although your cat will eat you when you're dead. But, you know, love what it can love you back, and that's not your agency. And that includes self-love. You need to love yourself enough to say, I need help. I need to talk to somebody. I need to make a change.
Let me go to Izzy. Izzy's been quiet. Yeah, go ahead,
The thing is, Bessie, that I wanted to mention, you said, you know, you get all these tests done, you go to the doctor. Mental health is health. I've seen officers that will go pump, you know, go in early to work out, and then work out while they're on their shift, and then they'll go home afterwards. Why aren't we thinking about, you know, the fact that we're closing ourselves up when we go home as our health, not just, oh, I need to work out to get stronger to go take care of, you know, whatever bad guys I need to take care of tonight.
Well, it's got to be holistic. It's got to be physical fitness, mental health. Absolutely go hand in hand. You know, again, like you said, you know, yeah, I put on lifted weights and I run it so I can chase the bad guy and something like that. Well, and part of your mental health is your physical, you know, what kind of shape you're in and all that. But you're absolutely right, Claire. Part of, you know, and I know people just like you do that they're at the peak of their fitness level, but mentally they're screwed up because they don't pay attention to the brain. It's all about the body.
You know, before,
when we have officers that are going in twice a day to go work out, rather than work out, you know, their mental health and their physical health, that's an issue.
It absolutely is, because I'll say before I go to Izzy, you know, I got to say to Bessie's comment, when you can run 3, 4, 5 miles, you're either doing two things. You're running to something or running from something. Which one is it? Because I guarantee you, when we're running, what are we doing? Thinking, trying to relax, trying to get over problems. So when you get there, when you finally reach that finish line, where you at? Izzy, come on, bro. You've been sitting back listening. This has been power today.
This is a great show. I don't even know what I'm doing here today. there's no points I can make that haven't already been made for the most part. I think one of the things that needs to happen more often in departments and in culture as a whole, first of all, policing in general is like a microcosm of the worst-case scenarios of what can happen when we let this stigma against mental health that is a national and international issue keep going. You can see the consequences of this happening. But I think when it comes to this stuff, we have to be – a lot of the solutions that we come up with are still reactive in some senses as opposed to proactive. So like what Claire and Betsy are saying, we have to be getting into our police academies and find out the culture that they're training them in. What are they building up to expect? And that goes into proactively, how is the job of policing being sold to people in this country? What is the environment being sold? How is it being presented to them? Because a lot of times, if you look at the way they recruit, if you look at the popular culture, the way policing is demonstrated in, it's not a realistic or honest projection of the job. And if you're not doing that, then you are going to get these people, like Stan suggested, who are coming in and kind of don't know what they're getting into. And that falls onto the other end of it, is how are you preparing them once they get in there? And you build them up into this warrior mentality, which you can go away with that or against it. But if you're going to give them that mentality, what tools are you giving them to prepare for being that way, to prepare for being on the edge? Because police officers that I've interviewed, so oftentimes they get out of police academy and they don't know how to deal with simple things like the adrenaline that comes from chasing down a suspect, the stress that comes with doing the job, the trauma that they experience when they go to their first call, a violent call or a small call. They're not trained to deal with these things, and they're not told anything about it throughout the academy. I mean, We rolled out the 21st Century Policing back in 2017, and I sat with an academy with a team of recruits to the academy for 6 months. And Claire was right. There's very little in the classes where they're talking about how to deal with the stuff that you're going to see and telling you what you're going to see in detail, in the graphic level of detail that you need to mentally and emotionally prepare for this. I mean, we've got field training. We have a year of field training in the NYPD where you're connected to a field training officer, and he's meant to be that person that establishes that you are using all of the best training that you got from the academy out on the street. But where is the mental health professional who's there for that year as well to make sure that you are mentally and emotionally dealing with and preparing for this once you're going to get on the job and you're not going to have a chaperone? So it's the need for proactivity, because in my experience, and again, all of you guys do this job, I just write about it, but in the people that I've interviewed and talked to, there's so much, a lot of the policies and procedures are all reactionary. Like, the problem has happened, now how do we, like, get the problem to go back down? We've got to nip it in the bud and get a lot of these problems out of the gate. And we're not dealing with it that way a lot.
Let me do this, because we're at the 17-minute mark, and I want to end this show clean because this show is too important, and I want to go down and give everybody about 2 minutes, and this is what I want you to say in your 2 minutes. I don't care how cockamamie it may sound to some people or how crazy it may sound to some people. You know, I want you to say what you would like to see and how you feel, and what policing can do to change according to you. Because obviously we ain't got it figured out. And it's not because policing is bad, because city council people, city managers, mayors, you got some responsibility in this. I hope you're listening. Don't go back. I don't want, this is my thing. I was a patrol officer for 25 years. I don't give a damn about SWAT and this person, and I don't care. I was there first. I called you there. You weren't there. I was there. So I want all the city managers, all the city council people, the mayors, the senators, congressmen, the governors, I want you to listen to this show. And I want you to make note of what you heard today from Betsy, from Claire, from Sean, and I'm gonna, because Claire, you're gonna end this show, and it's personal for me. I want you to end this show, and I mean I'm like floored by Betsy, and I'll call her and blow her phone up. She's like my sibling. We're gonna be in touch, but because I know you and know what you've been through, we don't have no sponsors here. This is real. What you people are hearing here today. And nobody ain't being paid to be here because I ain't got no damn money. So I just want, we're going to go around the board, because we're going to end this show like we started this show, like we did this show. It was real. And I just want, what do you want changed? What's your vision? Don't matter. It doesn't matter how crazy it is. What do you want to see? Because out of craziness comes stability. Big John, you up on the board first. What do you want to see changed in this topic, brother?
Well, I think that more proactive than being reactive. It's not a cop working that's not stressed out some type of way because of the way the job is set up. Some dude that was in the streets, I know some of you guys on the show today don't know my background. And I know the type of hell that I gave cops.
Take a minute and give it. No, John, you got time. Take a minute and give it, brother. We're going to do this right here. I ain't worried about time. When it comes to truth, time can wait. Come on, bro.
Yes. For those of who are on the show for the first time, guests and as well as listeners, I did 24 and a half years in prison. I was the former co-founder of the street gang as well as the founder of the drug organization. Actually, I founded two street gangs and a drug organization. And I know the type of hell that I've given cops. And I know where some cops are ready to lose their job because of the way that I flaunt it and did things in the streets. there's not a cop out there that don't need some type of evaluation. And most cops would never admit, I got a mental health issue. I did 24 and a half years in prison, and no one's going to tell me I got a mental health issue. I would never admit it. But my defense is, yo, man, you need some help, bro. There's things going on with you. You don't even realize that you're doing. What I would like to be able to see is that Joe Oakley walks in and Jim Devlin's office and say, hey, look, I went on and called Stan Mason, and something's going on with Stan. I don't know what's there. I would like to see Joe, speaking to Jim or Sean, taking seriously and Stan is pulled in for something to actually happen. Because there may be stuff, it don't necessarily have to be a violent situation, but it could have escalated. Something's really going on with Stan, or maybe Claire, she was consulted by Sean's wife. Look, Sean has been doing this type of, I don't want to bring it out, I don't want a whole lot of, noise behind it, but she consults Jim as her supervisor. I want people to be able to help each other before it escalates and becomes something crazy or tragic.
Mm-hmm. Amen, brother. I appreciate you, man. Let me go to Izzy. Come on, Iz. What do you want to see, bro?
I guess from my perspective, I'd like to see a little bit more humanizing of police officers when we have these conversations. Frustrating thing for me as a journalist, a police journalist primarily, is the lack of understanding from either side of the conversation and the polarization on the conversation that's happening that's allowing people like Claire and Betsy to fall through the cracks. There are very few reasonable people talking about these things and talking about these things clearly and concisely, or at least talking about them on a platform where they're getting heard by enough people. So I'd like to see more exposure of that type of thing, more humanization of police officers in the conversation of policing. And I'd like to see things done a little bit more impactfully. I mean, we talked about the George Floyd Act originally, and that act in its essence is supposed to be something that is to stop cops from causing harm. And if you want to lower the amount of time that cops get caught in misconduct and stuff like that, you want to deal with mental health and mental wellness in police officers. I've talked to too many police leaders and too many police experts that have told me that showed me an officer who's committed misconduct, and I can look into his record and show you 5 or 6 red flags where this could have been prevented from the get-go if we just dealt with mental wellness and mental health in officers. So I'd like to see the conversation being had in a little bit more of a complex level than people really want to have, because it's easy to blame police for a lot of this stuff, it's easy to ignore the humanity of police, but when we talk about improving police and reforming police, like, we've all got to take responsibility for the culture and the way that it exists today. Mm-hmm. We've all been there. We've seen this culture of policing that's popularized in media and television and movies and stuff. We're all part of it, So if we're going to change anything, we've got to humanize it and realize that everybody's kind of a person to a certain degree, and there are many opportunities to back out of a problem situation before we get to it.
All right, bro. I appreciate you. Let me go over Big Joe. Talk to me, brother.
And I've just got the ear on the floor because there's too much information out here that needs to be out. So I yield my time.
And I'm going to let you yield, but I'm going to say, this Joe is my ride or die. Joe is my – Stan's got issues and problems, and researching these shows, I relive nightmares. And Joe is my ride or die, whether it's 9 in the evening or 2 in the morning. Answers to phone. And, and so does Sean. I mean, I call Sean a crazy time. But for me, I never worked with Joe when Joe was a cop. I never worked with Sean when Sean was a cop. But these are people that when I call, they pick up or they call me right back. It may be nothing. It may be something. See, if we want to be a family, and this is my segue, and I'm going to let Claire in this. I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to do mine now. We want to be a blue family. I say get rid of the semantical bullshit. Be real from the heart. and the commonality. Sean has never not called me back. His wife, Vanessa, has never not called me back. Joe has never not called me back. That is a brotherhood. That is a family. That is what is real. If you're going to be real, be 100. That, I'm done. Sean, come on, brother. You got about a minute. Talk to us.
I agree with everyone on here. Indy, he's 100% right. So is John. So I'll take it to another crazy level. And why we reframe how we look at this is that, I think what we're doing is we're training everybody the same way as well. They should. They got to survive on the street. I need them to be worse than that. Training these people. Now, how they respond to what they see and what they do, everybody's got a different brain. And I think all these organizations that are meaning to do the right thing is trying to get everybody in the box to get them well.
Yep.
And that's where part of the problem lies. So, for instance, when you have Joe, who had his shooting, and Claire had her shooting, and I just ran into a really unique one the other day in a Bible Belt where an officer, righteous shooting, shot a pastor. Now, to him, and he's a Bible-thumping man, that's the ultimate sin. Those are three different kinds of treatment right there. The Joe I'm going to treat differently than I am Claire when it comes to the mental health of their situation. They walk the same path, but they got different brains. And I think we ought to expand the way we look at things and how we treat people, because it's all different. Our needs may be the same, but our brain's not. So I want us to think outside the box. And not put everybody in one box and categorize all our brains the same.
You know, Sean, let me say this. You know, I know Vanessa's at the function. But, you know, I love her. And let her know that I appreciate her so much, because when Stan calls and folks will say, Stan's crazy. Don't listen to him. But, you know, and I love talking with you guys, brother. I appreciate that both of you have always been there. You know, you always pick up the phone when I call. And you took time out today. I mean, you're sitting in your car, bro. I mean, you're busy and you're moving around. But when I called you to talk about this show, it was so important to you. You said, don't worry, I'm going to be there. And that's what we do here. We don't do optics. We do reality. So before I end with Claire, I got to go up to my brand new, I can't even call her, and this was bad, I can't even say little sister. I just got to say my sister, Betsy, I've fallen in love with you. I absolutely love who you, and I love your courage to just speak truth to power. No caveats and no conditions. 2 minutes, baby. How do we fix this?
So much. Again, I want to reiterate, first and foremost, to the first responders out there, especially the cops, that we have got to be a little more selfish about our own mental health and our physical well-being than we usually are. Nobody gets into this profession a selfish person. Mm-hmm. But we have got to take so much better care of ourselves. And we can't say, my chief needs to do this, my city needs to do that, my partner needs to do that, my family needs to do that. We got to look in the mirror and take responsibility for our own mental health. Now, on a broader scale, I want to say this. We are talking so much about police reform and all the bad things that cops do and all that, but I want to speak to this. Any politicians listening and our citizens as well. Police are not the problem. We have got to take a look at our communities. We have got to take a look at the political atmosphere in this country right now. We are in an era of depolicing where police officers have been so vilified and so abused that they are sitting back, not getting involved in situations that in the past we could have fixed, we could have stopped. Crime is on the rise, homicide especially is on the rise, violence is on the rise, and police are not the problem. We need to take responsibility for something, but our communities, our citizens, and our politicians need to take responsibility for what they're doing to make life harder for law enforcement and make life harder for each other. There is no reason that we need to be out there killing each other and filling our streets with blood and expecting law enforcement to mop it up.
Amen. Amen. Oh, Oh, you know what? And I'm going to tell you. So there's always, I will tear police up when they're wrong. I will tear them up. But we bring solutions. But we also tear up the community who has sat back, unattached, not at the council meetings, not at the school district meetings, you know, and you always got to, this is not a Republican, Democrat, a black or white, a police citizen problem. It is a problem in your city. Stan ain't got a magic bullet. Betsy doesn't have one. Joe doesn't have one. Izzy doesn't. The chief doesn't. You live there. I don't live there. You got to have skin in the game. That's our motto for the show. If you don't have skin in the game, don't call up here with a platform because we're not going to listen to you. And Betsy, thank you so much. You took so much time out to be here, and I know how precious your time is. But for you to take that time to come to this audience and this show, where there are police officials and public officials who will run from this show, because you run don't mean we won't call you out, because we will. But you did it, and I appreciate you. I love you. Thank you for being here. You're my little sister now. Or no, you can't be my little, you're just my sister. And congratulations on overcoming everything and fighting and being a fighter and speaking up. More important than speaking up for police officers, you speak up for women police officers whose presence is lost in the profession. Oh, you're a cop now. You're one of them. You go do. Not just in the community, but in the department. And thank you so much. I appreciate you, and I love you. Let me go down. My baby girl. You know what? You're closing this out because I'm so proud of you. I am so proud of you. Come on.
I wanted to speak to a little bit of what everybody said. As far as Stan said, be real. If you're going to be here, be real. Be authentic. And I'm going to speak to anybody that's listening as well. As Betsy said, you know, the politics matter. But as an individual, if anybody out there is listening, as an individual, you obviously care about what's being said here today, or else you wouldn't tune in, you wouldn't listen, you wouldn't care. If you are here, be true and authentic to yourself. Like I hope everybody here on the panel is, like I'm trying to do today, be true and be authentic to yourself and ask yourself, what are you really doing here? What are you doing to make a difference? Because you're here for a reason. So cut off the politics and cut off the crap. Be human. And what are you doing to make that change? Because what I'm trying to do is I want to go to give back to the community what I wasn't able to do as a police officer. Because I wanted to help people, but with what I went through, I don't feel like I would be able to do that as well as I could have before. So I want to help people in a different way. So I had to take my mental health by the reins and decide what I wanted to do. And I decided to be true, authentic, and real with myself and take responsibility and say, this isn't for me. And that's okay. That's cool. That's cool with me. I'm fine with that. But we need to look at ourselves, all of us, and say, what are we doing to make that change? What are we doing to be that change?
I appreciate you, Claire. You know, I'm going to end this show and say this. If you're listening to the show and you're going to share it later, all I can say is, you know what? As Claire said, be the change you want. Do you have skin in the game? What are you doing? Joe, 32-year homicide detective, back at work again. Working murders. Every time I call Joe, Joe's standing over a body. That's bullshit. You know, Izzy is up to his neck in interviews and stories. A man who changed his life, and he didn't say it, but I'm going to say it. And if the radio show runs out, the Zoom is gone. Because I want people to see this show from start to finish. John, 24 and a half years in prison, who owned up and said, I ran a criminal enterprise. I sold drugs. I did this, changed his life, got his voting rights back, is doing everything in the community. This show has got likes and clicks. There are no GoFundMes. Don't look for donations. I don't need nobody's money. I can afford Zoom. I ain't that damn broke yet. And God brings me people like Betsy, like Claire, like Joe, like John, like Izzy, where we open up the door to have the conversations we all know need to be had. And then for people who have professions, like Betsy, she's not going to say this. I'm going to say this to her as to why I appreciate her being here so much, and I'll say it publicly. This lady has a platform, a background, dealing with big companies, big people. She runs her business. But she took the time to be here. I am controversial. I am cutting edge. I'm not everybody's cup of tea, but that's why they make coffee. But she did it, and she came here 100. She didn't bullshit. She didn't walk around the issue. She came hard. To you men in law enforcement, you heard two women here today. And don't bother messaging me talking about what about the men. Bullshit. You know what? You can call up here. Y'all can reach Stan. What are you doing? That's so great. We're not trying to boost women above men or Republicans. This show is about let's just put the truth out there and all get better. Until we cut into the cancer, it's going to be uncomfortable. We ain't got no anesthesia. We spent all that on COVID vaccine. We ain't got no money. You will get it here real because Joe works murders real. Betsy works murders real. The chief works murders real. I went out there. Ain't nobody gave me no anesthesia. I walked up on nightmares. So guess what, America? You can hate the police, but guess what? You don't get to be numbed down here. You're going to get it 100% real, and it's going to come out. Now, if you don't like it, research it. And if you research it and still don't like it, get over it. Joe, get us out of here.
I was about to say on all of that, my friend.
All right, everybody.
Hey, Stan.
Come on, John.
I got to ask Stan one question before we leave. In your rehab, did they treat you or prepared you just in case that you was to get into another situation where it may require for you to pull your weapon? Your mindset. Did they give you treatment? Because another officer like me depends on whether you hesitate or don't hesitate. Did they treat you in any type of way in your rehab as far as that? If you understand my question, if I need to reword it, let me know.
No, I do understand your question. To answer it, I say yes. And the way is we don't go through, we didn't go through scenarios of, okay, here I have a gun, now you be the citizen and I'm going to try and put you in handcuffs. No, we didn't do that bullshit. Excuse my language.
Are you good?
I was sleeping right next to him. The fact that we were in group therapy and I was sitting right next to him on a couch and I was talking to them like they were a human. I was being human with them. I was being real. I was being authentic. And they saw my true emotions, and I saw theirs, and that was what broke that down for me and made that to be where, oh, I want this path, and I want to lead other officers down this path, and I think that's what Sean is trying to do, because they put me in a position where I was sitting right next to somebody just like you, and what do? Do I make friends, or do I run away from the situation? I absolutely do believe that they trained me to an extent of how to handle that situation better, because like I said, I befriended people just like you that I was taught in the police academy to put in handcuffs right away.
Wow. Everybody, thumbs up. Is that the bomb? That is the bomb right there. All right, we're going to get out before we go. Anybody have any last minute comments? I'm like, I love you guys. And I'm going to tell you, thank you for being here. You know, I'm just floored right now. The great show. This is one of the best shows I think we've ever done. one of the most needed shows, and certainly the seventh one, but the most poignant one on police suicide. So, Betsy, thank you, and I'll be texting you. I'll stay in touch, and if you get one that just says, how you doing, how's your day, you ain't got to comment back. I know you're busy. I want to be like you when I grow up. Joe, as always, thank you. Izzy, appreciate you, brother. You sobered up from the bachelor party last week. You know, we're all glad to see you can walk the straight line. John, always big brother, thank you. My baby girl, that's my heart down there. I appreciate you. Short notice. And you came in and you brought it. And you're 100. So people don't listen to nothing any of us said. I hope they listen to you because you live what we're talking about. Love you, Claire. And with that, we're going to get out of here. Everybody have a good day.
You too.
Bye.